Let's talk about the vagus nerve and the vagal nerve. What do you think about this? The tongue depressors, the laughing really loud and the singing really loud, and trying to stimulate that to help with the migrating motor complex.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you trigger the vagus nerve, so the way the vagus nerve is, when it's active, it's telling you it's food time. So turning on the vagus nerve turns off the cleaning wave, because if you cut the vagus nerve altogether, you get no acid in the stomach, you get reduced migrating motor complexes, and of course the stomach gets delayed and all of that. So turning on the vagus nerve would do the opposite. So in other words, you get more acid in the stomach, so maybe that's beneficial. But it also, when you turn on the vagus nerve, that's what you turn on when you want to eat. So we don't know that turning on the vagus nerve makes any difference. We think it actually would make things worse, because it would sort of convince your gut that you're in eating mode when you're not.
So I went to the acupuncturist. She put some needles in there. She was like, oh, I'm helping your vagus nerve to get stimulated. And all this, I'm assuming that's what it was. And then all of a sudden I went into like, oh, I'm so chill. Like, it was an instant parasympathetic response. So is that good for my migrating motor complex? Or
the answer is, we don't know 100% for sure, because it hasn't been studied with a tube down looking at migrating motor complexes. As you know, that's a challenging thing to put that tube in, and not too many centers do it. But if you, like I said, if you're just about to eat food, you start turning off the cleaning waves, because you get vagal activation. So the brain, through the vagus nerve, is telling the stomach, start producing enzymes, stop the cleaning waves now, because we don't want the food going all the way to the colon, and start producing more acid. Food is on its way. When you start to eat, the vagus nerve turns on even more, again, further inhibiting all those activities or augmenting those activities. So we think turning on the vagus nerve makes your body or your gut think it's going into feeding mode. Now, there's also a back signal from the gut. When you have food in your stomach, you feel, I feel good. And so the back stimulation is the satiety centers in the brain are activated and you feel satiated. And so you may feel good from vagal nerve stimulation from the signals going this way, but it may not be helpful from the signals going down the other direction.
Very interesting. Okay, these are sort of bullet points. People are wondering about SIBO and fiber. How do we get enough?
Now, so the bigger question is, what is enough fiber, and do we really need fiber? And the question other than that is, after eating cardboard for 20 years, have we made an impact on colon cancer at all? And I don't know that we have good answers to those questions. And so a lot of people have been eating fiber because they think it's healthy. And then now everybody's going paleo and going to even keto diets, and all these diets seem to be even healthier than high carb diets. So I don't know that you need a lot of fiber in your diet. I think fiber can be helpful in terms of if you're a normal person and you want a nice smooth bowel movement, and maybe fiber to help the beneficial bacteria of the colon have more food. But for SIBO, fiber is no good either.
No bueno.
It's just a lot of fermentation, a lot of gas, and a lot of trouble.
So that leads, I think, most of us to be thinking about the low FODMAP diet and how we don't want to allegedly be on it for a really long term, because it reduces the variation of the microbiome in terms of variety and that kind of thing. Do you agree with that? Should we be? So that's what makes me think, like, fiber may lead to more diversity in the microbiome.
Right.
What should we be thinking about?
So fiber, yes, leads to more diversity in the colon. But as I've said before, if you put fiber in the gastrointestinal tract, like beans, it's going to take a lot longer for cleaning waves to recover. It's going to take a lot of time for the fiber to evacuate from the small intestine, leaving more fermentables there for gas, bloating, and distension. And this, in part, I guess, is a nidus for low FODMAP. But the low FODMAP diet is not healthy long-term. And even those who discovered and continue to discuss low FODMAP diet have suggested that. Bill Chave from Ann Arbor, Michigan, presented at the ACG meeting the first study looking at how bad is it to be on low FODMAP. And the answer is after 3 months, you start to see micronutrient deficiencies. So it is not a long-term solution to IBS, is what it's, you know, touted for. SIBO is kind of the extension of it. Now, it can be helpful. So I kind of tell people, if you don't eat any food at all, your SIBO will disappear because the bacteria get no food. But that's not a solution. So, but the more you restrict calories, the more better your SIBO will feel, but then you're going to cause harm to yourself. So you've got to find that best practice for you, which is why we sort of developed the low fermentation diet. We developed that in, like, I don't know, 2001 or something. And it's meant to be 100% recommended daily allowance of all minerals, vitamins, so that you don't get the deficiencies, and yet calorie restrictive enough to help SIBO.
So when it comes to that diet that you're talking about for when you're taking the rifaximin or your treatment, and you're saying eat whatever you want because we want the bacteria having a party so that they're out and about so the medicine can do its job of killing.
Yes. So I don't tell people to go and eat a gallon of Haagen-Dazs ice cream every day to make their SIBO go away. But, you know, you want to be a little more open with your diet during SIBO treatment. That's what I suggest. I mean, what you'll end up happening is you'll feel worse on the treatment, thinking that it's the antibiotic that's making you worse when it's actually the diet. So I just tell people, just go about your normal business, eat what you normally eat while you're taking the treatment. You don't need to hyperactivate the bacteria.
And nor would you suggest, like, really being super strict on a low fermentation diet.
I would suggest not to be on a low FODMAP diet while you're taking the antibiotics, because you are restricting calories to a great extent, and bacteria will tend to be more resistive to antibiotics in hibernation.
Okay. So let's talk about the gallbladder and rifaximin and SIBO. What are your thoughts on this, I don't want to call it a trend, but this development that some people are working with a partially hydrated, no, partially hydrolyzed guar gum and rifaximin with this whole bile connection?
Yeah. Well, guar gum is sort of a fiber as well. And so there is some turning on of bacteria with guar gum. What are you referring to? I don't know. Maybe I'm not understanding the question regarding
some of the people who are working with rifaximin are finding some improved results in their observations and their practices by adding some partially hydrolyzed guar gum to their rifaximin treatments.
Yeah. I have no problem with that. I think that you're basically augmenting the feeding of the bacteria. In the context of a gallbladder or no gallbladder, I'm not sure.
Okay. I think it was something about the bile. If we don't have good bile production, would it mean that the rifaximin might not work as well for us?
So bile is like soap. So if you have a lot of soap coming through the gastrointestinal tract, you're going to kill off some of the bacteria. So bile is actually good. And in fact, some people think that the bacterial overgrowth that occurs in cirrhosis is due to a change in the composition or the quantity of bile. So bile good, no bile bad.
And how can we improve our bile? I think Dr. Seebecker's taught me about bitters. Is that something that can help us?
Bitters. Some people even take bile. There are encapsulated, I guess, ox bile or other types of bile products. I'm not suggesting that because I don't know how good that works. Again, very little data. But my point is that bile is basically like an emulsifier, but it emulsifies fats and lipid layers of bacteria. So it will be a detergent for the bacteria to some extent. But remember, bile gets absorbed, so it doesn't work all the entire length of the gut, only the first portion.
Interesting. Okay, changing gears just a little bit. A lot of people are wondering about parasites. Do you see a relationship between parasites and SIBO? And let's say they've done some stool tests, they were actually I'm going to say lucky enough to find that they had a parasite, because they're so hard to determine, which would you treat first?
So if they had a parasite that was detectable, I would definitely treat the parasite first before treating SIBO. There is a link between Giardia, for example, and the development of IBS. So they have Giardia, they've traveled to a location where Giardia is common, they get it, they come back, they detect it, treat that first. But there are some patients after treating Giardia, they still have SIBO. Now, it turns out Giardia has vinculin in it. So maybe that's what's triggering the post-infectious IBS from Giardia.
Wow. I've never heard that before. Thank you so much for that. Wow, that's intense. Okay. So breath testing, there's some controversy around it. We have somebody out there on the online world talking about how maybe SIBO doesn't even exist. I'm not even going to give it a lot of energy, but what are your comments on that?
Well, so this notion that maybe SIBO doesn't exist is a little extreme these days. I remember the days when I was saying SIBO and nobody believed it, and now we're sort of at the other end of that spectrum where everybody believes it except for a few who say, I don't believe it. I'm not here to convince people one way or the other. The science has been convincing. I mean, there's over 100 papers on treating with antibiotics, and the methods that I've outlined here in this so far over an hour of discussion. But let me leave you with this. So in a study that we were presenting, I started to talk about the results, but I'm going to finish it now. Just rifaximin, and forget about all the different types of treatments for SIBO. We have seen a 30% reduction of referral to my center for diarrhea IBS / hydrogen SIBO in the last decade, concurrently with the increasing use of rifaximin to treat diarrhea IBS. So you could say that they're still there, it's out there in the community, but the community is treating it before it gets to me, and they're having success because they're not sending them in. Or they're being treated and they're in that 30% group, one and done. So we have eliminated 30% of the population with diarrhea IBS from the pool of patients who require tremendous amount of CT scans, testing, expenses. So we're reducing the cost, we're reducing the disease burden by 30% already. And that's the ultimate test. The ultimate goal is less patients with this disease, period. And we're already seeing that. So if you can be a naysayer, but you're in a small camp now.
Okay. What should we call a positive methane-only breath test?
I think it's a methane bloom. I don't know that it's SIBO, but the argument there is if methane is positive and hydrogen is always flat, it means that everywhere there's a hydrogen-producing bacteria, there's a methane bacteria eating the hydrogen. And we know there are some hydrogen-producing bacteria in the small bowel in almost everybody. So the methanogens must also be in the small bowel, whatever that means. So it's a bloom, and it includes the small bowel.
If someone doesn't have a lot of money, right, they can't really afford a SIBO breath test. They're fairly educated about, you know, their alternatives. Their doctors may be even willing to give them a script for rifaximin, even without a breath test, just based on symptoms. Would you encourage them to just, like, carry on, or are you like, test so we know?
No. I mean, so in the trials we did, like, so let's go back to this, because it gets confusing. People say, well, is it IBS or is it SIBO? So rifaximin is FDA approved for the treatment of diarrhea predominant irritable bowel syndrome. Diarrhea predominant irritable bowel syndrome is you have diarrhea mostly, and that you have bloating and distension and changes with what's having discomfort in the abdomen. That's diarrhea IBS. That's exactly the same symptoms as SIBO. We know from breath test studies, we know from small intestinal aspirate studies that 60% of diarrhea IBS is SIBO. So the trials for diarrhea IBS, which is the diagnostic your diagnosis is diarrhea IBS, but the most likely cause of your IBS is SIBO. Diarrhea IBS as the indication for rifaximin. Well, those trials, you didn't do a breath test, you just treated, and it worked. And those were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It worked without a breath test. Now, it leaves you in a somewhat of a mystery, because what if it doesn't work? Then maybe you do a breath test then. So I'm of the mind that in the hydrogen side of things, if you treat and you get 80% better, it can't be anything else. I can promise you that Crohn's disease will not get 80 to 90% better after 2 weeks of an antibiotic. It won't. Celiac disease will not get better after 2 weeks of rifaximin or an antibiotic. So if you take 2 weeks of rifaximin without a breath test and you get 80 to 90% improvement, what else can it be? It almost can't be anything else.
Okay. All right. A couple of people are just wondering about these connections. So SIBO and FMT.
Yes. So the highest hydrogens I've ever seen were patients who were very severely affected after FMT. So if you have FMT, and in particular those that are given by mouth. And back in those days, and this is different now because they put it in capsules where it releases in the colon, which is a much better way to go. If you release it in the small bowel, where they used to put a tube and pour the material into the small intestine, that was no good either because we had some of the highest hydrogens ever. There is a study for diarrhea IBS that's being published. There's another study that was presented at the Digestive Disease Week and other meetings. Other studies are emerging showing that it either makes you worse or doesn't make you better. So I would predict that these trials will fail, because why would you put more bacteria into a situation where you accumulate bacteria?
And FMT, just so everybody knows, is fecal
microbial transplant.
Microbial transplant. Okay. If you have SIBO or you have surgery, and for pain medicine, they give you codeine, which is an opioid. What would you take if you had SIBO? Would you tell your patients, like, hey, if you can take another thing like a Tylenol or something, do that to avoid the opioids?
Well, so if you have an extensive surgery, you will be in pain. So yeah, you have to do something. And I have patients where they will take prophylactic treatment during the surgery to prevent SIBO from reaccumulating. If they're doing well and they've been stable and they are going to have surgery and we're anticipating high pain, they might take prophylaxis. Again, this is off-label use. It's not a FDA-approved use of treatments for SIBO or IBS or any of that. But some people do that. The alternative is, remember that if you take narcotics, you have to be on narcotics for 10 to 14 days straight before SIBO develops in a normal human. Now, in a person who's got a low MMC already, then that may be shorter. But if all you need is 2 or 3 days just to bridge the first couple of days, I don't think that's going to be a terrible problem.
Very good.
Now, most surgeries that you're taking a high amount of narcotics in the first couple of days, you're not eating much anyways in those couple of days to fuel the SIBO. So again, if it's just for 2 or 3 days, it's the patients who have very bad back pain or other indications for long-term narcotic use that it's more problematic.
So somebody asked a question about, could SIBO be actually causing their back pain?
I've seen a lot of things disappear from treating SIBO, but I've never seen back pain disappear from treating SIBO.
Okay. Do you see any connection in your practice between viruses like Epstein-Barr and SIBO?
So the answer is no. We haven't seen that connection so well. But I have patients. There's been a number of cases that we've seen over the years with encephalitis from viruses that we think of damage the vagus centers in the brain, and then they get SIBO as a result of that. I had a patient who had severe viral meningitis. She was actually incapacitated in bed and slowly over time recovered. And it wasn't until she fully recovered the SIBO disappeared. So if you damage the vagus tracts, whether it's in the brain or along the tract, another time we see, not to get off topic, but sometimes patients get radiation for Hodgkin's lymphoma in the neck and they damage the vagus nerves, they get SIBO also. And those are harder to treat as well. But direct viruses like Epstein-Barr, which affects more the liver and the spleen and lymph nodes, we don't see that too often.
And so traumatic head injuries, do you see SIBO more prevalently?
We do sometimes, and that's a hard one to treat.
Horrible, yeah. People are also asking about, we were just talking about opioids, they're asking about like antidepressants or other drugs that are like Adderall or Ritalin. Because of the impact on their nervous system and their sympathetic nervous system. Do you think that those medications could possibly inhibit the MMC?
So, I mean, anything that would block nerve transmission, like serotonin antagonists, they have the potential to potentially reduce MMCs. I always thought that tricyclics would also, you know, contrary to what it's used. For example, tricyclics are used for diarrhea, IBS, and to reduce diarrhea. I always had the thought that they would reduce the migrating motor complex as well. The problem we have with the migrating motor complex is if we had a non-invasive test for that, we would test all these theories of what drugs are making them more, what drugs are making them less. But because it's such an invasive procedure, we don't have a lot of information on which drugs inhibit, which drugs make it, you know, make the migrating motor complex more robust.
Also, there was a question about, like, if you have a cold or a flu, and do you think any of those over-the-counter medications could impact the MMC? And then also, a lot of people who have SIBO tend to have insomnia, and so they're taking the Unisoms of the world. Do you see that impacting MMC?
Don't know. Don't have an answer to that. I've never seen any study, to my knowledge, that's tested that.
So can dysbiosis in the large intestine, they're saying high LPS, cause the MMC to malfunction leading to SIBO?
So the LPS is lipopolysaccharide, generally from gram-negative bacteria like E. coli. LPS, when it gets into the system, it activates a whole bunch of sort of fight or flight reactions because it's like you have an infection or you feel unwell or you feel weak or fatigued. Can it inhibit migrating motor complex? So the indirect evidence we have for that is that when we tested and we published our paper on MMCs, when people had treated their overgrowth and the overgrowth was gone by the time we did the MMC test, the MMCs were better. So not having SIBO made the MMCs better. Still abnormal, still not normal, but better than patients where SIBO was currently still active at the time of the MMC testing. So does that make sense? So you have overgrowth. Overgrowth is almost making your MMCs worse to keep themselves there. So is that due to the LPS? I don't know. Is it due to some chemical the bacteria producing? Probably. LPS seems like a good culprit, but I don't know for sure.
Could a chain of events lead up to SIBO over time, weakening the MMC? So people are asking about stress, lack of sleep, impacting the MMC, obviously eating too frequently. Food poisoning obviously triggers what we've been talking about. But what about the rest that are not autoimmune, such as food intolerance? Can food intolerances cause SIBO?
I don't see that too much. I mean, mostly SIBO is causing food intolerances, so it's hard to sort through that.
So I guess
stress is an important question because stress decreases MMC. We know that that happens, but it doesn't cause SIBO per se. So let me give you the study, and I've quoted this study with you before, is that the U.S. military studied the deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan of tens of thousands of people. They looked at whether they had IBS before, whether they had IBS when they came back. And what they found was you go to Iraq or Afghanistan, you get deployed there, you come back, a lot of people had IBS. Now, what they looked at was all sorts of factors that they experienced in those countries during their deployment. And if you were shooting your weapon, active combat, injured, killing other humans, all that kind of stressful activity, you were not more likely to develop IBS. So stress and anxiety and super you know, extreme stress that you experience in active war did not predict the development of IBS. The only thing that predicted the development of IBS was food poisoning. If you were in those areas and you developed gastroenteritis, you're more likely to get IBS. So we don't think stress is a cause, but it is a modifying factor that makes the migrating complex worse. And if you already have overgrowth, the overgrowth can get worse with stress.
Have you ever seen genetics impact the possibility of having SIBO? So there's two questions there. One is, if my sister has SIBO, am I more likely to have SIBO? And then the other one is about the genetic SNPs.
Yeah. So there are genetic things that are being determined. The group in Canada that studied the outbreak of gastroenteritis in Walkerton did do some genetic work and find that there was some cytokine genetic abnormalities that were predicted. IL-6, for example, had some genetic mutations that may have predicted the development of post-infectious IBS, for example. So we think there is some genetics to it. The problem in, you know, with the Mayo Clinic study, where they tried to look at genetics, the problem is there were connections between family members. But remember, when you travel to a foreign country, you travel as a family. And you all get sick from the same food. And so it can be that your sister has IBS and you have IBS, and it all stems from your trip to, I'm not going to name a country because I don't want to insult anybody, but you started on a trip that you went on, you ate some food that caused trouble for you, and you had gastroenteritis, and ever since then, both of you have it. So,
That can happen to us here in the States or anywhere, right? Yeah,
exactly.
Right, okay.
Like there was a nurses' convention where a group of nurses ate at the same buffet and they got IBS. And so it happens.
Have you seen how gluten might affect SIBO, people eating gluten?
So this is a complicated issue because even the FODMAP group has proven that the gluten restriction in low FODMAP is not necessary. That gluten really isn't the major concern for IBS treatment. Again, assuming that a good proportion of IBS is essentially SIBO. If you go on a gluten-free diet, essentially, in part, you're going on a lower carbohydrate diet. And we know the bacteria love the carbs. They don't care about the sugar, or about the oils, or the proteins. So, if you're on a low-carb diet, you're essentially using a lower fermentation diet, and therefore you will feel better. So the problem is you get trapped into this no-gluten diet because you think it's the gluten, but it's actually the low carbs. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't people who are truly gluten-sensitive without celiac. I think there is a group like that. But what I'm saying is that if you have SIBO, going on low gluten will help, but it's not because of what you think. It could be because of the low carb diet that you've just put yourself on rather than the low gluten.
As we get older, does SIBO get worse? Like, do we have more of a chance of getting SIBO because we're older?
So I get a lot of questions similar to that. SIBO increases with age, absolutely. So if you're people over the age of 60 have a higher tendency to get SIBO. We also see more methane as people get older. In the 90-plus group, that's the highest methane rates we see in all of our population as a whole. but another question is, if people ask is, I've had SIBO for 20 years, is that harder to treat than somebody who has had SIBO for 1 year? And the answer is no. You know, just because you've had symptoms for 20 years, you never saw a doctor, and now you're seeing a doctor, it's just as easy to treat the 20-year SIBO as it is the 1-year SIBO.
That's encouraging. If somebody's on a budget, what would be your best suggestion for them in dealing with SIBO?
It depends on the budget. Some of these drugs are very expensive, and I understand that fully. If you really wanted to be on a budget, then try the diet first. If the diet restriction works really well, and I don't mean low FODMAP, the low fermentation diets out there somewhere on the internet. I think Allison's site has some version of it as well. And if you feel terrific, then maybe that's all you need. But, you know, I can say that, for example, rifaximin is getting more than 90% covered by almost all healthcare plans now. And I think in part because it actually is saving money, because if you have a 20-year-old woman with IBS, why would you do a colonoscopy if 2 weeks of rifaximin makes them better? You know, it saves money, less colonoscopies, less testing, less blood work, all sorts of stuff. So insurances are covering it. So hopefully if you have some form of insurance, it will cover it.
And just to clarify, correct me if I'm wrong, the SIBO low fermentable diet is not going to cure your SIBO, but it certainly will help you feel better by managing your symptoms. Is that true?
That's correct. And so for some people, it's really works well, but I don't think you're going to get more than 30 or 40% benefit from it, 30, 40% improvement.
So maybe like we're lucky if we have the 20.
Sorry?
You think 20% improvement from the diet? Is that what
No, I think 30%, 40%, that can happen. I mean, not with everybody, but it depends how religious you are with the diet.
Okay. So this has to do with people who are trying to figure out that very important piece of SIBO treatment, which is the prokinetic. So can you describe a couple of bullet points of what can help with prevention of relapse when it comes to SIBO?
Yeah. So our goal is to not to need to treat often. The less often we treat, in my mind, the better we're managing the patient. So the way we, you know, if you take a treatment like rifaximin and then you're fine for a year, then you get a relapse, you don't need to do any prevention. Because why? Why would you suffer for 365 days taking a pill or a drug or a chemical to prevent something that's going to happen a year from now? Because what are you going to do? You're going to take a pill for a year to prevent something for an extra month or an extra 2 months or whatever the case may be. If you relapse within a month, 2 months, then you need to take something, because you can't take rifaximin every month, 12 times a year. That's just, you're almost half the year on it. So either you look for some other cause that's causing it to relapse early, or you take a prokinetic to try and trigger the cleaning waves. The one we use most commonly, again, off-label, is erythromycin, because at a very tiny dose, it activates migrating motor complexes. Now remember, migrating motor complexes only occur when you're not eating. So if you ate just now, you take erythromycin, you're not getting a cleaning wave. You have to be 2 hours without eating before you take erythromycin, before it's working on cleaning waves. So usually we say take at bedtime and try not to eat any calories for 2 hours before. But the second goal is try to do the diet. But again, you don't need to do the diet if it's a year before you relapse, because then you're just making you and your social life miserable with being too choosy at restaurants and not being able to live your life. My goal is to live your life, your best life, and try to take things as less often as possible, and taking the antibiotic as least as possible.
What is your take on biofilms and biofilm disruptors?
So there's a lot of work being done in this area, and a lot of research, good research being done in this area. The question with biofilms is, a biofilm is sort of a protective layer as well. It's not just it can be good and it can be bad. So if you disrupt a biofilm and you get rid of that film along the bowel, are you actually allowing things to come in that wouldn't otherwise come in because the biofilm is there? Or is the biofilm a special type of biofilm containing bacteria you don't want that are causing trouble to you and you should get rid of it? And that is the question I'd like to pose to the audience, because I don't have the answer to that question. And I don't know what's right or wrong yet with biofilms, because there can be a good biofilm or a bad biofilm. And how do we know which one it is? So it's a little perplexing. And as you know, there's a tremendous literature on emulsifiers in food, you know, as an unknown ingredient like polysorbate 80. And these things can actually be contributor to, for example, obesity. There have been some links to obesity that these things are in our food items. So, and that's an emulsifier. So I don't know that there's going to be an easy final answer to emulsifiers until the data is more clear.
When you're thinking about the MMC or even SIBO in general, have you seen visceral manipulation helping?
So visceral manipulation we've used, for example, for adhesions. And I have some patients who've benefited from visceral manipulation. The question I have for visceral manipulation is the reasons adhesions get bigger is because as the things are moving, they're tearing, and then new scar forms, and then they tear, and new scar forms. So is it increasing adhesions by doing visceral manipulation, or is it breaking down the ones that are causing blockage, and that's a good thing? And I think it's probably a little bit of both. And I have seen some good success with it. But the problem is you can't quantitate adhesions, not easily, not the ones that are not obstructing. So there's no scan you could do that says you have 5% adhesions or 10% adhesion. We don't have a quantitative measure, so it's a little difficult.
So when it comes to underlying causes, and you're there, you're talking to your gastro who may or may not have a lot of background on SIBO, and you guys are trying to figure out an underlying cause. I kind of asked this before, but so it's treat the SIBO because you've tested and you see that you have it. And then if the SIBO goes away, and then if it relapses quickly, then you really need to look for the underlying cause. Otherwise, you're saying don't obsess about it. Is that
sort of what I'm saying? So remember, 80% of the cause of SIBO is probably the migrating motor complex, which isn't something you can obsess over because that is the underlying cause, which is why we don't test everybody at the beginning. Again, my goal is not to bankrupt people. So if it's SIBO, treat it. If they get better and everything's fine for 6 months, forget about it. You know, it's got to be the migrating motor complex or some mild version of that. If it comes back in 2 weeks or a month and you can't get it under control, start looking, because you don't want to miss a cancer or miss an adhesion or something that could be remedied in a different way. So again, the way I treat patients, they come into my office. If they're classic SIBO-like symptoms, treat first. If they don't get better, then we start to investigate.
When someone's getting an MRI, is there a specific technique that they should ask their doctor to help? I mean, aren't there certain, like I had an MRI once, and they didn't get a lot of images, right? So I felt kind of like it was an incomplete picture.
Well, MRI is very motion sensitive, so you've got to stay really still, and sometimes the quality of the images don't come out as good as you would like. MRI is good for looking for like tumors and pancreas and all that kind of stuff. And there really isn't a special way to look at those. I mean, if you really wanted to look at the pancreas, there are pancreatic protocols and other more specific ways to look. But if you want to look for adhesions, MRI is not the way to go. What you want to do is a barium study. And the problem with barium studies is there's a barium study and then there's a barium study. And what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of peripheral community hospitals, they give you the barium, you drink the barium, they take two pictures and they say it looks fine. And I've had this happen a number of times. You're going to hear a helicopter here in a second. We got a level one trauma center and it flies right over my building if you hear it. That's what it is. But you do a barium at a community hospital. Two pictures, they charge you exactly the same price as we would a barium study here, and we take 28 shots, moving the bowel around with a paddle, isolating every loop of small bowel. So, you know, if you get an expert barium person, you can find adhesions if they're there. If you get just a two-shot barium study, you're going to miss adhesions. I'm sorry, you just will. So.
What a shame. How often is a structural problem found on a barium SI series after a CT revealed nothing?
I don't know the answer to that, but the CT doesn't show adhesions at all. Now, if you have a full-on blockage of the bowel, you're going to see it on CT because the bowel will be all dilated and puffy and full of fluid and so forth. But a small, subtle adhesion that is very positional. So, for example, remember, when you have if you grab, I'm trying to talk about like a hose, right? You have a hose in one position it's kinked and won't let water through. But in another position, it unravels a little bit and water's flowing. So a CT, you're always on your back. Mm-hmm. You're lying flat on your back. You go into the tunnel. They do a CT. In a barium study, they get you on your left side. They get you on your right side. They get you standing up. They get you lying down. And you could be hanging like a hook with an adhesion, and you only see it when you're in the upright position. And so barium sees all the different body positions and sees where the adhesion's grabbing on and how it's hooking onto the bowel.
And then once you see these adhesions, it's not like you're going to get surgery to remove the adhesions.
So obviously adhesions beget adhesions and surgeries beget more adhesions. So taking adhesions down by surgical procedures can actually make more adhesions later. And so there's always this debate about what to do. Now, if you're distended, miserable, you can't go on in life without at least trying something, then we send these patients to surgery and they often do much better. I have so many cases like that. Now, there are cases occasionally where they do operation for the adhesions, they feel great for 4 or 5 months, and then the adhesion comes back, and then it's all back again. I hate that, and they hate it, of course, because we were hoping for the miracle, and it isn't always a miracle.
Okay, as we've got some sort, they're not random because they're real, but they might be a little bit of an outlier set of questions. Have you ever seen SIBO and hair loss, if any?
You know, I've seen hair loss occasionally come up over the years, but it's not a consistent theme, and I can't say that treating SIBO makes hair better. I just can't. I mean, occasionally I'll have women who say that the quality of their hair is different when the SIBO's gone. Less, I guess frizzy, I guess, is what the term that they use. But I can't say that that's something that is definitively noticeable.
And what about oral iron? Because a lot of people say that their ferritin levels or their iron levels are impacted when they have SIBO. Mm-hmm. And then they're taking oral iron and it can constipate them.
Right. So there is a possibility that iron goes down with SIBO because the iron's being used by all these bacteria. B12 can be down in SIBO because B12 can all be used up by bacteria. Generally, folate goes up. Bacteria produce folate. And one of the ways they test dogs for SIBO in veterinary world is they do a folate level. And if the folate level is super high, dogs get SIBO and they treat it with antibiotics and they do much better. So humans are not dogs, but it's the same principle. The bacteria produce folate.
Okay.
We see a lot of elevated folate in our patients.
And is that something that a human should deal with? Should we try to reduce it?
No, I mean, folate is not toxic at high doses. Like, for example, during pregnancy, folate's given because it's a good thing. Folate's good for pregnancy.
So speaking of pregnancy, if somebody has SIBO and they're pregnant, do you have any suggestions?
So I just had two patients brought their babies in and they had a very successful pregnancy. If you have SIBO and you're planning pregnancy, plan your pregnancy because it's not, I would say that there are some diseases, for example, Crohn's disease, the rule is a third get better, a third get worse, and a third stay the same during pregnancy. What I find is that during pregnancy, most women with SIBO get better. Women become superhuman during pregnancy. It's absolutely amazing. Well, you're superhuman in general, but women become just unbelievable. It, like all functions kind of upregulate and turn on and are augmented during pregnancy for the protection of the fetus. And I have seen time and again, SIBO patients get dramatically better during pregnancy. I have one, she's now 6 months postpartum and she still doesn't have SIBO recurrence. And she still doesn't need anything and breastfeeding, everything's going great. Now, it's not 100% like that, but a good proportion. So don't not plan a family because of SIBO. Now, adhesions are different because if you have adhesions, the uterus can really push those around and cause more problems over time.
So do you see that some people actually get more SIBO after they have a baby?
If they have adhesions, you mean?
Yeah.
If they have adhesions or they've had, for example, previous surgeries, even endometriosis surgeries is a big situation because they get a lot of scar tissue. Yeah, I mean, the pregnancy can make things a lot worse, or for some of them, not everybody, but some of them.
And what about SIBO? Have you ever seen a relationship between SIBO and C. diff?
So in all the years we've used rifaximin, I have not seen a case, in my clinic at least, a case of C. diff. Rifaximin is purportedly able to treat C. diff. In a study versus vancomycin, it was roughly equivalent. So I don't think C. diff is a big issue, although it is in the label for rifaximin for DIBS, because there was one case of C. diff in the Target 3 trial or third trial.
So some people who are worried about C. diff are hesitant because of that on the label. Is that what you're saying?
I guess they would be. But in that case, the patient developed C. diff long after they completed the rifaximin, and they were taking a cephalosporin for a urinary tract infection. So it was probably the cephalosporin that did it and not the rifaximin, but it gets tagged to the rifaximin because the FDA can't say for sure.
And what about people who have SIBO and microscopic colitis? Is the word collagenous?
Collagenous colitis, yes.
Yeah. Do you ever see a relationship there, or this is another question where people are asking, which do you treat first?
Well, if you have collagenous colitis, treat the collagenous colitis, because I don't say that there's a relationship between SIBO and collagenous or microscopic colitis, because we don't see that, but we do have patients, and it's typically a female person or a woman in their 60s or older that get these microscopic colitis type events. Nobody knows the cause. But treat that.
And is that similar to ulcerative colitis?
No, because ulcerative colitis, there's a plethora of drugs that you have to treat, harder to treat. In fact, microscopic colitis is relatively a lot easier to treat than it used to be with budesonide, which is a type of steroid that doesn't get into the bloodstream as much.
Could you repeat the name of that one more time?
Budesonide.
What's the first letter?
B, like Bob, like boy.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about Resilor for a second, because there are a lot of people who are, this is a prokinetic for any of you, you're just learning about SIBO in the beginning here. Resilor, do you hear anything about it possibly being available in the United States soon?
I know Shire has the rights to Resilor, and I suspect that they will be looking for FDA approval of Resilor at some time in the future. But that's all I know at the moment. Resilor is a prokinetic that's available around the world. Shire has the rights in UK, for example. In my opinion, it's one of the best prokinetics we have on the planet, and it's very effective.
So some people don't have a great reaction with Resilor. They get TMJ. Have you ever heard of that before?
Mm-hmm. Well, have I heard of TMJ or happening from Resilor?
Yeah. Or, oh, no, I know you've heard of TMJ before, yeah. But TMJ happening from Resilor.
I never seen it.
Okay. Okay, so straight up, what if I have SIBO, I take rifaximin, I have a negative breath test, but I don't get better? We've kind of already
talked about that. That's one of the things we're presenting at DDW.
Yay!
You have to wait for that one.
Okay, that's cool. Have you ever seen SIBO and a flu-type response happen simultaneously and swollen lymph nodes?
Not so much swollen lymph nodes, but we've seen sort of flu-like effects, foggy sensation or sensorium, feeling like your thinking is not super clear. I'm going to digress a little, but in patients with liver cirrhosis, it's believed that they get cloudy mentation because of all the bacteria coming in. The liver's not filtering it. So there's two ways for the liver to be overwhelmed. One is the liver can't handle it because it's cirrhotic, and then the bacterial toxins and other chemicals from bacteria make it past the liver. Or there's so much stuff coming to the liver can't handle it, and it gets past the liver, which I think could be what's going on in SIBO. To be honest, I think in my experience, and again, not published, is that the methane bugs or the methane patients are more affected by this fogginess than the hydrogen overgrowth. There's something about methane that is at least associated with more of this cloudy sensation.
Speaking of prokinetics and brain health, what about LDN, low dose naltrexone? What's your take on that? And do you love it? Do you like, oh, if it works for you, great.
Yeah, I mean, I use it on and off. Dr. Rezai, my colleague, uses it a little more often. He's happy with it in some patients. You know, the thing is, look, if everything's going really well and everything's easy. We don't use prokinetics at all, maybe a little bit of diet and that's it. It's when it's hard and it's refractory and the SIBO is hard to treat that we start to look at all these other options. And to say that I've never used it is wrong. I have. And, you know, I can't say that there's one magic thing in the tough, tough, tough cases.
And speaking of tough, tough cases, what about MCAS and it being a cause for SIBO? Then there's the Ehlers-Danlos, and then there's POTS. And we recently did a masterclass in Q&A with Dr. Leonard Weinstock, who talked a lot about this. What's your observations about that? And any advice you can give anyone who feels that that's a factor for them?
Yeah, you know, I really feel for these categories of disease because so challenging. EDS is so challenging. POTS is, I wish I could relate some of the stories to you, but I think they're too emotional because they're really tough. These patients suffer immensely and nothing is really happening. I had a very particular patient that I have, I was very fond of, but she passed away from POTS. And these things are, we need to get better answers. And maybe it's due to the microbiome in some of these cases or whatever it is, but POTS is becoming a real serious problem and more recognized.
So in case somebody wasn't at that seminar, what is POTS for somebody who's just listening?
So it's postural orthostasis tachycardia syndrome. Essentially, your autonomic nervous system is not behaving correctly. And you get very wide fluctuations in pulse, wide fluctuations in blood pressure. You basically feel terrible. And in addition to that, because of autonomic dysfunction, the gut doesn't function well. And it's almost like somebody's playing with the dimmer switch on your electricity. And it's sometimes up, sometimes down, and patients just can't find an even keel, and it's really hard on them. But I've seen it so much. It's real. It's just we don't have a good solution for it. I mean, there are treatments. There are autonomic centers. Stanford has a very good autonomic center. We use them a lot. And they've been very helpful in trying to get patients a little balanced. But there's no magic cure for it yet.
Have you seen a relationship between H. pylori and SIBO?
So Helicobacter hepaticus, which is not H. pylori, Helicobacter pylori, has CDTB and can cause IBS, we believe. But Helicobacter pylori, we don't know. But at least we don't think it's causing SIBO. But there are patients who have Helicobacter, think Helicobacter is the cause of their symptoms, treat the Helicobacter, but didn't realize they actually treated SIBO because it's an antibiotic regimen, and they got better. So they treated H. pylori, but it was actually treating SIBO because in many countries, H. pylori is almost everybody has it after the age of 60. It doesn't mean almost everybody has SIBO. H. pylori is very common, not so much in the West these days.
Have you ever heard of Yucca shidigera, S-H-I-D-I-G-E-R-A, helpful for methane? I don't know if it's a yucca.
That's a new one for me, no.
Okay. And have you ever used homeopathy to help your patients?
I haven't. Again, I've seen a lot of patients doing these types of things. It's just like probiotics, for example. I do have patients who take probiotics and swear that it's made their SIBO much better. 6 months later, they're in my clinic saying they're suffering from SIBO. I said, well, what about the probiotic? Well, it stopped working. So, you know, there are a lot of things that can work and do work or work temporarily. Allison actually taught me that some of the products that are used for methane, they work, but temporarily, and then they wear off, and then a few weeks later, they're back to square one, or a few months later. So yeah, there are things that might work, but we need long-term solutions.
How about the thyroid function and SIBO?
So I haven't seen a lot of relationship, but there is a relationship between autoimmune diseases and autoimmune diseases. And a lot of the thyroid diseases are autoimmune. So for example, we see in scleroderma patients, which is another autoimmune disease, that anti-vinculin antibodies are highly prevalent in that population as well. And that's the only other population that has high anti-vinculin is scleroderma. So, you know, people who tend to get autoimmune diseases tend to get autoimmune diseases. And so maybe there's a link there, but I can't say that we know for sure with thyroid specifically.
When you have patients come to you, they have chronic diarrhea or they have chronic constipation.
Yeah.
Probably associated with either the hydrogen or the methane constipated hydrogen diarrhea. And they need to eliminate if they're constipated, and they need to stop eliminating if they have diarrhea. Do you have any go-to protocols or suggestions?
You mean to treat specifically the symptom?
Yeah, to treat those symptoms in particular. Yeah.
So our whole philosophy at our center is we don't treat symptoms, we treat cause. But there are times where no matter how hard we try to find a cause, we end up treating symptoms. So there's a lot of therapies for constipation, ranging from Miralax or laxatives to magnesium to prokinetic agents to secretagogues like Linzess or linaclotide and placanotide and newer ones on the block. So, and we use all of the above as needed in the appropriate setting. On the other side, to stop diarrhea, a lot of different things, of course, Imodium, any antikinetic, Zofran, which is ondansetron, is a highly effective at improving diarrhea in the toughest of the, in some tough cases where we don't understand what's causing the diarrhea.
Could you say the name of that one more time?
Ondansetron. Zofran is the trade name.
Okay. Any observations about Lyme and SIBO? There's a lot of talk about that.
Yeah, I don't know that Lyme causes SIBO. Lyme can cause all sorts of disorders of function of the gut. It's sort of a great deceiver because it can affect any part of the body in different ways. Whether Lyme causes SIBO or is unknown to me. I do see some cases, though, where they have both. The problem with SIBO is it's very common, and so it's common to see SIBO in other conditions, and therefore it's tempting to say that the SIBO is caused by it.
So people are still asking, because when we get that migrating motor complex arrest, and they're like, no coffee, guys. You can have coffee, right? As long as there's no calorie in it, right? Or a sweetener that tells your body that there's a calories, like stevia. And then an herbal tea.
Right now.
He's having some coffee right now, guys. And then would a little bit of herbal tea would be okay, too?
Herbal tea's fine. Even caffeinated tea is fine, as long as there's no sweetener or milk or sugar in it.
Okay. No calories. Bottom line.
Correct.
Bottom line. Okay. Weight gain with SIBO. We talked about people who have weight loss, and what about people with weight gain?
So weight gain is very common with SIBO, and especially in the methane side. So we've attributed some weight gain. For example, in a study that was by our group here, methane, if present in an already obese population, was associated with the obesity having 50 more pounds of weight than in a non-obese population. So in other words, if we took people with a BMI over 30, the ones with methane had 50 more pounds, or almost 7-point BMI higher than if you didn't have methane. Now, that doesn't prove cause and effect. That's an association. And then we looked at the general population of people doing breath tests. And if methane and hydrogen are both on that breath test, they had a higher body mass index than people who didn't have methane on the breath test. And then we treated the methane in a small group of pre-diabetic patients, and their glucose got better when the methane was eliminated, and their metabolic parameters got better. So we're really excited about what we can do with methane and what methane's doing to us, and how we can make a lot of things better I'm not saying it's the cure to obesity, but we're going to chase that one. Dr. Mathur at our center is chasing that. She's part of our group.
Very cool. We have about 4 minutes left. People are asking about when they're doing elemental diet, do you ever recommend doing antimicrobials or rifaximin at the same time, or is that just double duty?
It's not just double duty. I mean, one of the things, as I mentioned before, is bacteria go into hibernation when they're starved. Now, by day 10, they're starved so much they can no longer hibernate. They don't have enough energy and they die, or they're passed out in the gut. But if you give antibiotics, you're really throwing them in the toilet because they're in hibernation. They're not going to be affected by the antibiotics as much as if they were fed. So I would suggest don't waste your money.
Okay. Resilor, are you comfortable with people staying on it long-term?
So Resilor, as I said, we'll hopefully have it on the market in the United States shortly. The laws do allow obtaining in patients who desperately need something that isn't available in the U.S., the laws do allow obtaining these from outside, and there are ways to get them. In Europe, my colleagues in Europe have great success with long-term use of Resilor and have conveyed great experiences in terms of long-term safety and other things. So very excited. Hopefully it'll be on the market here, easy to get in the coming year.
And is there a preference for you between Resilor and low-dose erythromycin?
Erythromycin's cheaper. And if it works, go with the cheap thing. Because even if Resilor is available, trust me, drugs that are new are expensive, as we all know. And so if erythromycin's good enough, go with that.
If people are, you've been talking about PPIs, what if they have the reflux and SIBO? So it's not even, so they're taking PPIs or they're not, but acid reflux, GERD, and SIBO? Do you see a relationship?
Well, anything that increases pressure in the abdomen will make more reflux. So when you're distended and bloated and that pressure, you're going to have more reflux if you already have reflux to begin with. And so getting the SIBO down actually reduces the amount of reflux patients often experience. It doesn't mean reflux is gone. It just means it reduces because you've reduced the pressure in the abdomen. Often, if I have a patient comes in, say they have classic SIBO and they have reflux, I'll treat the SIBO first and see what the reflux looks like after. And if reflux is gone, then one treatment took care of both.
1 minute left to go. If you have, if you're doing meal spacing and I take a supplement or my medicine in between, is that going to mess my migrating motor complex up?
So I'm ask that again.
I'm doing my meal spacing and I'm supposed to take some medicine or a supplement. Will that stop the migrating motor complex?
Potentially, because a lot of pills have filler, carbohydrate filler, lactose even. Check your pills. They contain lactose. It's unbelievable. You should look at the ingredients of lactase enzyme. I think you'll be shocked. They have sucralose in the sweet ones. So it doesn't make sense to me. That's what I understand anyway. You just look at the fillers of pills because they can be a problem.
When someone is looking for a doctor, how can we suggest ways for them to find them in their area? Do you have any suggestions for that?
Doctors that treat SIBO, you mean?
Yeah, doctor. Is there something we should, I have a whole lesson in one of the courses about how to do that, but do you have any suggestions for them? And then we'll wrap.
So I don't have a master list of doctors in the country. I have my go-to people all across the U.S. that I know, but I don't have it written down where somebody could search and say, I'm in Atlanta, who do I see? Unfortunately, first of all, I probably wouldn't be allowed by Cedars to do that, Cedars-Sinai, but it's tough. I know it's tough for patients, but most good gastroenterologists, most large groups of gastroenterologists are very good at this. And, of course, a lot of naturopathic physicians are very good at treating SIBO, and Allison has been, and both of you have been very effective at educating the community. So there's hope.
Perfect way to wrap it up. Thank you so much. We have you out at 6 p.m. East Coast time to the minute. We really appreciate you, Dr. Pimentel, and we will see you learning more about Digestive Disease Week, first week of June, and then, of course, here with SIBO SOS on July 12th. Thank you so much.
Take care.